Welcome to today's edition of Take a Leap and Transform, a Neo Diversity Journey podcast, where entrepreneurs, employees, business owners, and individuals can become aware and transform their mindset. This is the first of a two-part interview. My guests and I had such a great time, and we went over so much information that we end up going over time. So enjoy the first part of this two-part interview. Welcome back to Take a Leap and Transform, a Neo Diversity Journey. I'm your host, Joseph K. Muscat. Are you ready to take a leap with me? Transforming a business to be inclusive for Neo Diversity can be viewed as a daunting task. And this can be even more true if you're a micro or SME, where you have targets or overhead to manage. For them, they ask why they need to be. They may not see the benefit, or they aren't aware or don't know how. In a recent blog post and podcast, I express my recent experience in visiting the Human Resource Convention, where I met with a number of HR professionals who could see the need for Neo Diversity inclusion, but didn't know how to implement the changes. To help with this conversation and to talk about her experience and how she transformed her company and to shed a light of guidance to businesses, no matter the size, I am pleased to have on the show Helga Alou, who was CEO of Playmobil Limited till September of 2012. The group was originally set up in Malta in 1971 with some 50 employees as an extended workbench to the German operations. At her retirement, the company employed over 1,000 employees and was the largest German manufacturing company in Malta. After her retirement, she set up her own consulting company, Advise Limited. She is a board member and chairman of various Maltese businesses. Over the years in Malta, she held various posts on board of constituted bodies and governmental organizations. From 2009 to 2011, she was the first female president of the Malta Chamber of Commerce, Enterprise and Industry. She is a board member of the Rotary Club La Valette, a board member of J Malta, a board member of the BOV Joseph Kalia Foundation, and the president of Core Platform, the Malta National CSR Platform. Helga is married to Joseph Anthony Alou and has two children, son Christian J. Alou and daughter Chera R. Alou, and is the proud grandmother to Maya, Thompson, Marcus, and Frank. Her family has always been her top priority, and she always stated that her biggest achievement has been to combine family and professional life. Welcome, Helga.
Welcome, Joseph. Glad to be on your broadcast.
I want to start off with the focus on culture. Truth be told, there are many cultural elements that are in play and need to be considered. For instance, there is a culture of country or region, and then there's the culture of the organization. As a former CEO, can you address not only how important it is to understand the culture and as well as how to do you involve with it?
Well, Joseph, for me, it was even more important because obviously being German, when I came to Malta in 74, it was my first appointment outside of Germany and into a Mediterranean country. Obviously, way back then in 1974, Malta was a different Malta than today. And it was quite a bit of a culture shock for me, coming from Germany, which is always very well organized, disciplined, into a bit of a backward Mediterranean small island. So for me, the first thing I remember when I started working here, and we were a very small company, only some 50 employees, and very young, all very, very young in our 20s. And when my administration personnel came and told me, now tell us what to do. And I said, no, you need to tell me how are things being done here in Malta, because I need to get to know your culture, especially your business culture, in order to see how I can work within this new culture. So it was important for me to obviously know how things were done in Malta and as well involve myself into the business area. So I joined as well the Malta Federation of Industries, which at the time, obviously all the institutions and bodies and authorities were very male dominated, much more than they are still today. But coming as a young German woman from a manufacturing company was quite a novelty. But again, I needed to get to know how they conduct business in Malta. So listening and observing the Maltese businessmen, learning from them their ways was of utter importance to me. It was of importance to me as well, because if I wanted to establish a culture within the company Playmobil here in Malta, I had to bridge between the Maltese culture and the German culture, because the company is German owned, in order to achieve the optimum of both cultures together. I hope I answered your question, Joseph.
You did, and thank you so much for that. Very insightful. I mean, definitely male dominant culture, you being a female woman of business coming from Germany, definitely would have a cultural shock on both regards. And the need to understand, you know, the culture that you have arrived in. It's kind of funny, you know, when I relate to myself being Canadian and being so close to the United States, we've had a number of American businesses cross the border and come into Canada. And they think that Canada is basically another American state. And Canada, even though we share a lot of similarities, our values, our way of thinking, the way we produce things, where Canada's a very forward-thinking country, but from my experience, we're very conservative at heart. And the American system never got that. So, I mean, I remember speaking to someone who used to specialize in retail and helped bring in a lot of American companies over in retail. And they wanted to do things the American way. And it didn't work out because, in particular, if we take a look at, they have a prom. And in America, proms is a very big thing. Proms are in regards to a turning point in a young adult's life when they leave from high school and go into college, university. And they said, we need to flip all the stores because now is prom season and we're going to sell a lot of prom dresses. And she said, turned to them and said, no, proms are done here in Canada, but they're not that big. If you flipped your stores just for prom dresses, you're going to lose money. So there's a culture shock to overcome. I mean, and just recently back in 2014, we had Target move to Canada. And within a year later, they were running back to America because they lost $70 million and didn't understand the culture of Canada. So it was a huge understanding culture when you immigrate. And that's something that I had to learn when I moved to Malta, was embracing and understanding the culture here, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to do business. And it's interesting in the aspect too, you know, the male dominant side of things. How did the male businessmen take you? And also, how has things changed since then?
Well, to be honest, Joseph, first and foremost, I tried as much as possible to listen, to see their interactions. And then I must say, because wherever I went in Malta, they really did look up to Germany. They always thought that Germans are very disciplined, very correct, very efficient. So there was a high recognition of some of the German values in a general way. So then when I sort of knew a bit and came in with my own ideas, sometimes or own comments, sometimes as well bringing my experience from Germany to the local thing, saying, because as I said, Malta was quite backwards at that time. I mean, remember when I came, for example, we used to give our employees their wages every week in a paper bag, in notes, in normal money, which for me was Stone Age, coming obviously from Germany, where we all had bank accounts and you would never get a cash payment. So, I mean, though certain things I brought forward and I asked, obviously, always, what were the reasons? I said, why on earth don't we pay by bank transfer or checks? And I got the reaction they said, but people don't have bank accounts. I said, but why not? They said, well, various reasons, because our employees at the time already were more or less unionized. And the unions told me, well, the men don't want their wives to know what they earn. So if they earn whatever, five Malta pounds at the time, they give their wives the three and they keep two for themselves. So, I mean, you get to know all this culture thing as well. I mean, obviously it has changed over time. I think we were one of the first companies who paid then by check and then later, obviously by bank transfer, and we were one of the first companies who had an ATM on the workplace, because my people worked on shift and I said they can't go to a bank and queue in the morning and waste their working time. So the POV at the time very much open to my suggestion, opened the ATM, which was a prime location in an industrial estate, and all the other company said, why does she always get her way? But I didn't always get my way. I was maybe the one who put the idea forward before anybody else. I mean, I've always been a person of trying to see how can we do things better and improve. So I have always, as I said, I listened a lot, observed a lot, and when I spoke, I tried to be to bring something positive to the table, to start them thinking of better ways of maybe as well learning from what we did in Germany, how much it could be applied. So I think over time you earned respect. And I think I did that by not criticizing them, by listening to their reasonings, but also trying to put forward more things. But why can we start not slowly changing? And it was taken on. What I liked as well, and what I observed a lot, as you pointed out, being very male dominant, that when you sometimes have these presentations on quite maybe difficult subjects and everybody listens and these big words being used and very abstract, and maybe being as well a bit straightforward and blunt German, I at the end said, look, could you please do the whole thing again and say it in layman's terms? Because I didn't really get what is important or what you wanted to tell us. And then I find a sign of relief all around the table, because I think I wasn't the only one, but others wouldn't have owned up to it. But that was maybe the privilege I had as a female, saying, listen, I need to learn, I don't know. And I didn't mind that, because I think, like I said, I learned a lot, much more by being very outspoken about it and open. And in a way as well, I think I showed at an early stage that I would appreciate their culture. I'm not here to criticize. If there's changes, I wanted in the positiveness. I loved the country. I loved the people from day one. I'm anyhow a people person. So I think even that was felt, that I was not here to look down or to be critical or to see everything in a negative or old-fashioned way, but I was there to actually help to improve things. And especially when we talk Federation of Industry, where we were all manufacturers together, to try and see how we foreign companies could integrate within the Maltese business culture and help everybody to change for the better, to improve. I think that was a major thing, that you need to build respect and trust, and that has to as well done by being consistent, being positive, listening, seeing other people's views, and then see how together you can come and create positive change.
Wow, that is absolutely amazing, Helga. And really interesting in the historical cultural aspect that I wasn't aware in regards to the, definitely Malta in a lot of ways, and still is, a very male dominant society, but the aspect of being payment in paper bags through notes and no bank accounts because they didn't want their wives to know.
We are going back a long time.
That's definitely going back a long time, but that's interesting. But yeah, I really like a lot of things that you said there. Being respectful to listen, respectful to observe, not criticizing, and listening to the reasoning. I think there's a lot of really key elements in there that led into what you said earlier about communication and the importance of communication with the business community, with the community at large, and the people that you employed. And especially, like, you know, I think you're right, you know, in regards to, from my experience, again, coming from Canada, it takes outside thinking, which is usually immigrants coming into the country and saying, well, have you thought about doing things this way or that way to implement change and to implement, you know, getting everybody else on board on doing that. And that requires, again, a lot of the points that you mentioned, being respectful, not criticizing, but also coming back to communication. And I think communication is a very important aspect. So from my experience, communication is one of the most difficult and misunderstood elements, where there is the myth that because you've communicated, there's the assumption that you're understood. What have you found to be the most proactive way to communicate successfully?
Well, look, I mean, for example, I mean, communication is one of the most difficult things. I found that as well when I used to run the company, but even now with clients sometimes. And where I still, to a certain extent, I have, I think, mellowed a bit or changed as well a bit, because in Germany, for example, we keep private and business very separate. So in business, you are very straightforward, you're very direct. And when you criticize, it is always very factual and it's taken positive, because a criticism is taken as that you want to tell a person how it can improve. So it is never negative or partial negative. It depends as well, how it's said. But I remember quite often at school or even at business when I trained, my supervisor was telling me, listen, you did this one wrong, you can learn like that. And there wasn't anything sort of, in my opinion, wrong with that. But I immediately knew that in Malta it wouldn't work. You see, that's where you then have a different culture. You have the Mediterranean culture, which is much more emotional. So when you need to criticize, you need to point out that people haven't done it the right way and how they could do it better, you need to do it privately, sort of person to person, four eyes only, not with the open thing, and need to do it in a bit, maybe be a bit of a gentle and positive way. Also, what then happened as well in Malta is their history of having been dominated always by foreign powers. So you need to, this is part of their DNA. So these people are very sensitive of the Thelsworth. So they want to you have to be very, very careful when you criticize in a way that it has to be not a criticism, but more trying to help them to improve. So I couldn't take it the German way, where we would do it totally different. So when you learn about how the people here act to it, you can do it. I mean, I learned that with my employees. I mean, obviously we were all youngsters, all very, very young. And I mean, I immediately learned that they had a big drive to learn. They wanted to learn. They wanted to know more. They said, if a German can do it, we can do it. So it's this real power to be as good. And that was actually very, very positive for a company, because you could build on that. And I love to teach them and told them why we did things in Germany this way. So as well for the employees of the company, they understood as well the German owners and German management style and didn't take it negatively. So I could bridge that as well. But also this drive of learning, of knowing, was so positive for the companies. I mean, for the company. I mean, we had employees who, when they were 18, started as technicians who ultimately became the manager for operations. I mean, the continuous learning curve, so keen on it. And that was a strength in the company we had. And I think it was at that time, I mean, I'm talking way back, obviously, when we started the company, but that was such a value we had in our employees, this drive for their own development, which obviously is something I embrace totally, because I always felt as well that I continuously learn, and the more I learn, I can improve. So whatever I know, I can start delegating and teach others, so I can learn new things. And then it's sort of the way we as well embraced it in our company. So we became very much a learning company, always looking for new ways outside, not trying to invent new things, but looking what others are doing and seeing the way they go about it, and not duplicate, but take lessons learned and seeing how we could incorporate some of them into our own company culture. So I think that was one of the most positive ways I found in the young team I had, that they were very, very loyal, very hardworking. And I mean, they had a thirst for knowledge, for evolving, for learning and getting better.
Now that's actually quite fascinating. You know, it's also funny that just quite recently, I was listening, reading actually, in regards to how a lot of companies are developing their own universities within the company, because the focus is on ensuring that the team, the executives, the people on the floor are always learning, always looking to improve. And in fact, in some of them, the employees are in somewhat mandated as part of their job to spend either an hour or 2 hours learning through the university and taking a course, because they want to excel and, of course, help retain them and help them to achieve different levels within the company. So it's quite interesting how, in some ways, you, especially for Malta, you were a pioneer in that aspect.
I think, yes, Joseph, we were. We actually, because what I told my people, is our employees as well, or I call them my people, is that what you know, it's yours. You take it with you. You own it. The company can use your knowledge and your skill, but you are the owner of that. So this is something, if you learn more, if you have better skills, if you improve, it's something you do for yourself. Not for the company. The company uses it, but you can walk out of the door and use it somewhere else. So as well, to instill in them this knowledge that they are doing it for their own good. They are not doing it because the company needs it or wants it. You do something for yourself. And I think that needs to be as well brought forward to them properly. We actually went so far, because then obviously being in manufacturing, and we worked round the clock. So we had four shifts and Saturday, Sunday work. So training was not, or learning was not always very, very easy, but we had a training center and we had outside trainers, adult trainers, because as well, you need to find the right trainers. You can't teach adults like children at school. So we had proper professional adult trainers, and we were very supported by the local government in that respect. And we had different modules. So at different levels in your part in the organization, we started way back, obviously, at that time when the whole computerization came up, that you could learn IT skills because they were lacking in some part of the company's employees. Then there was learning English properly because some of them spoke English, but maybe not as fluent as possible because of the education level when they started the company. Then we had as well employees which were originally like warehousing staff, were actually employed for their physical strength, but then it changed with computerization into barcoding in all our machinery with the technology. It was, you were much more of a IT and computer knowledge necessary than actually physically. So we had all these different modules, and we agreed with the union that in order for changing from one level of employment to the next, you actually had to show your own development. So, I mean, people had to sort of buy or attend these modules in order to gain. And we as well made a deal with them to say, that you have to give 2 hours. It was not, wait a minute, let me try and see it properly. It was 52 hours per year of your own time, not company time, to learning. So you could take some of the company time, I think it was another 52 hours, which you could do during company time, but 52 hours of your free time. So it means after your 8 hours, you stay 1 hour more to do this module. Because we wanted as well to tell the employees, look, as it is for your own good, give some of it to yourself. You know, we never, how shall I say, we always as well taught people to be responsible for themselves, to take on certain responsibilities. I mean, you are a person, no matter where you are in the company, so you are responsible for what you are doing, what you want to get. And so as well, you have to give. It's, you know, sort of can't just, I mean, the company can't just give and give. Yes, it will use the knowledge, but you could as well use this knowledge to say, I'm going to another company. Because in fact, some companies were telling me, but you, with all your training, aren't you getting your people ready to go somewhere else? And I said, I'm never afraid of that. First and foremost, if the company has an environment which is conducive to what they like, they won't leave. If our payment is on the good market level, there's no need neither. But if people have better opportunities somewhere else, yes, let them go. Let people grow. You can't keep them. You know, they are not prisoners of the company. They are free people. So I never felt that was actually the case. And we had very loyal employees, as I told you. I mean, we had people who started when they were 18 years old till their retirement, literally, and climbing the ladder in the company. Because if they always see that they can improve themselves and that they are part and parcel of the whole organization, that they feel empowered to have their say, that they know what the company is doing, feeling good about it. It's not only money, people. I think people want to feel good. I mean, I always said, I mean, work is not a negativeness, not a prison. You don't have to go to work. What you do in your life, you have to feel good about it, because only then will you do it in a good way. And in fact, we always say, let's have some fun. Let's enjoy going to work. And I mean, we all have our good and bad days, but let's have more good days than bad. Let's enjoy going there, being with your good colleagues, having a good environment, having a laughter and a thing. But then, yes, we are, we set ourselves very strong targets. We have to achieve them. We are very competitive. And I think it's a style. How shall I say? It's a culture of a company which you have to build over years. And I think the most difficult one in that, Joseph, is A, communicate it all the time, but also be consistent. It takes time. And one wrong move can really take you down all the way. So you have to be very, very consistent. You have to be always aware of what you are doing, how you are saying it, how you pass your messages on. If you do something, we all human and we all make mistakes or whatever. I did that all the time, but I'm the first person to then say, oops, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. You know, be human, acknowledge. None of us is perfect, but let's acknowledge it and let's learn from our mistake and say, oh, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done, or I didn't mean to. It came across wrong. I think that as well shows your human element, and it will be acknowledged and appreciated, I feel, or I always felt like.
I completely agree. Because at the end of the day, I mean, let's just go back here for a second. I like the aspect of, you're right, that they own it. They own the knowledge, all right? And I think that was very important. And I like definitely the aspect in regards to that. One, they had the opportunity to develop themselves within the company, but at the same time, they had to take ownership to do that on their own outside. So it was somewhat like a marriage, right? We give a little, so you have to give a little. And you're completely right that people, when they understand that they have to own it, and that's their knowledge, and that at the same time, there's this symbiotic synergy going on between employee and employer, then one, their self-esteem starts to improve. And at the same time, they're starting to feel valued. They're valuing themselves and they're being valued by the company. And as that is absolutely fantastic that you pointed out there. And it's a very crucial aspect. And there's a couple other points that you brought up, but I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. Because the aspect of being valued is a topic that I would like to further expand on. Because one of the most difficult hurdles to overcome is dealing with these preconceived notions, especially for those who are neurodiverse, whether they are seen as being difficult or low skilled. This can either come from the manager or this internal belief that they developed over the years. So with that in mind, how do you address these preconceived beliefs?
Well, I mean, Joseph, in one aspect, what I always felt, I mean, I think even in my own person, when you learn over the years and when you climb up in your career. I mean, I found, for example, in our company, the biggest issues we had was sort of middle management. And I think that is what, I mean, I'm feeling as well, and over the years, heard it a lot from other companies too. When you grow, because I mean, our company grew exceptionally fast. And as you said, I mean, we had over at one time 1,200 employees, so far too much sometimes, and you kept to the level which I knew from way back, where you literally knew everybody in the company. I still, till the very end, I walked the shop floor every morning and every evening, but I didn't know every single employee as much as I would have liked. But so middle management became very, very important. And for them, I think middle management is a very difficult role, because you are part of the overall management, but you are very close to your segment or to your business unit in the organization. So you are sometimes torn a bit, I think, between being part of your whole employees in your unit, but also fulfilling the role of top management, which drives you to certain targets and whatever. And I always felt that I told my middle managers, sort of the line managers and whatever, please tell us in top management the issues, because you are there, you would know, and we need on top, we need to know in order to do the right, to give the right direction. We need to know what is felt. We need to know the pulse, because when you grow very, I mean, like in our case, quite large, it is very difficult to know that. You know, you lose out on this intimate knowledge, but the middle management is so important then, but they have to be as well empowered to be open to tell top management the issues or the problems there are growing up before they become big issues or really harmful for the company. So they have to feel as well empowered to be very open and very honest and be able to say so. So it was very important to empower them and letting them come out with sometimes things which we didn't always wanted to hear, but we had to face facts in order to deal with them properly. And I think even in today's culture, I think one mustn't overlook how important this middle function in any organization is.
Completely understandable. But I'm going to go in a different direction now, because you've touched on a couple points here. Because the middle management, I agree with you, middle management is a crucial aspect. Because when we take a look at statistically at an employee engagement is significantly low. And the core of engaging employees starts with the manager. And with that in mind, though, we have to take into account with the right management and how they, being so close to the team, how they are reading into and identifying the challenges or identifying the strengths of their team members, in particularly neurodiverse individuals. So when we take a look at middle management, I mean, we have to take a look at one, do they have the skill set to be able to do that and to be able to focus on the aspect of, all right, we have somebody who's ADHD or we have someone that, you know, has reading issues, you know, I don't know what the problem is. Someone coming in or such as myself would say, well, they may have dyslexia, right? But obviously the manager wouldn't know about that. So this comes into the aspect when they communicate to the top level management, they're communicating with them with this misunderstanding and not having the knowledge. So in some ways, yes, communicate to top management to say these are the problems, and you know, to help improve efficiency. And on the other hand, these are the problems, in my opinion, they're, again, preconceived notions. They're slow. They're not, they don't have the skill sets. How do we deal with that aspect?
I mean, we always invested heavily in training our middle management through some outside trainers who then knew our company very well and all. But also we had, let's say, weekend sessions where top management and middle management worked together over weekends to come out with the right thing. The thing is as well, Joseph, you have to have a culture or how shall I say, encourage a culture where managers in every position are empowered to say no to you, to the top one, where they feel that they could, you know, you don't want yes people who just, like I say, yes to everything you're saying, but you want people as well who are critical. Let's say me as a managing director had some ideas or whatever. I didn't want my managers just to say and not and say yes we do. No, I wanted them to tell me, is it possible, Would our people understand it? Is it the right direction for our businesses? Does the outside understand it? Are we on the right track? How could we do it? I mean, you know, as we were always a bit ahead of normal, we always embraced very new thinking, like, let's say, with our supply management, our suppliers, we embrace suppliers who had the same mentality as us. So they knew our company well, because we felt it has to be a holistic circle. We need to know as well that we have suppliers we can trust. We know that they did things in the right way, treat the employees the right way. So, you know, but I wanted then our purchasing managers to embrace that too and say, is it correct? Can we do it? Do we find enough good suppliers? You know, but we need, I feel so. I think in Malta, the training of middle management is sometimes not emphasized enough. And it's not easy to train that, because like in my case, a lot of our managers, line managers, so business units managers, came actually from being employees on the lines before. So they stepped out of their colleagues and one step ahead. So it's even more difficult for them than to be in charge of them, sort of. But that's why they needed not, they had this the technical knowledge of their production and of what they needed, but it was more the strength in how to deal with human beings, how to be, when you have to be strict and when you have to be lenient, when, you know, I mean, sort of the HR element. So HR as such, I don't like human resources. I mean, it's people management. But we took it straight away very early on in the direction it became later or today known. But don't forget, at the time when I'm speaking of the 80s, a personnel manager just did the payroll and the records of an employee, sort of to take care of employees, of their training, of an environment of, I mean, we had a company newsletter where things were involved. I mean, our people were involved. They knew what was going on. So our management team, I think what was important as well, that even our middle management knew that they were supported very, very strongly from top management. They could be open to us. They could tell us their issues with the employees. So if they needed some help, where they didn't have the knowledge or the skill, we came in. And then we had a very, at one time, a very solid HR department, where we had a whole key on development, on people's development, and the other one was sort of the process, data and the payroll and all that. That was a different one, but the more important one was on the whole development in every stages of our organization. Because then as well, like you said as well, Joseph, and where we talked about quite in-depth between ourselves, was as well to see the potential of every single person in your organization. We all have strengths and weaknesses, and especially when we talk about an inclusive organization, we take it straight away that we think of people with special needs. But we all have our special needs, you know. I might be strong on one type of skill set, but maybe weak in other areas. We all have our good points. So what you need to, as well, is it's very very early when you have assessments of people where their strengths are and build on their strengths. Because then the weaknesses will be overcome, and build on their strengths and put their strengths where they really can use them to the utmost and where they can help the company most. So, I mean, because sometimes people are put into areas where they don't feel strong, you know. I mean, you're trying more to overcome their weaknesses. And I would say rather build on their strengths. Don't look at the weaknesses. They will overcome them if they build on their strengths. but it's assessment of people, which is then very, very important. And I think we need to look a bit at that, that we are all a bit very individuals. You can't just make general norms and use the strength of other people. I mean, even on your lower level, between employees, you have some who are more leaders to their other colleagues and others who are followers, and you see them. And if you see a bit of people who have this leadership at a low level, I'm not saying they are managers, but they can put people around them and can influence them, like we call influencers today, but use them, because these are people very useful to you, because there are certain other people who like to follow, who need a strong hand to lead them. So you need to see all that in your organization to help these people, because it's strengths they have, but also to help to use, to not use, but to help your organization to build this strong how shall I say, pyramid of all the strength in each individual of your people.
Yeah, I mean, once again, there's definitely a lot of points there. I mean, definitely middle management needs more support and training, and they get that from top management. And you also hinted on the aspect of being strength focused, not weakness or challenge focused. And a lot of companies, from my experience, don't do that. The importance of focusing on the strengths and building on that. And you also, the last point you mentioned on, I mean, surrounding yourself with either what we call the neo-diverse community as a neo-diverse team, someone that can support, you know, your challenges and also help support your strengths and help them take it to the next level. You know, whether that's a circle of influence or in particular, going back to some previous points, and in fact, into the next question, a circle of mentors. And from the beginning, you've mentioned about the importance of communication, the importance of learning, and also training and supporting, whether it's management or team. So there was this constant repeated message, and you actually during our prep talk had echoed the same message that Pascal Tucart, who I recently interviewed for the podcast, who was a business leader in management, he said that business leaders and management need to become mentors. They need to become coaches. And you said the exact same thing earlier during our talk today and also in our prep talk. So I believe it's a crucial point that may not seem to be comprehended well. And why is it so important for managers to not only have this understanding, but also embrace the practice of being a coach?
I mean, that maybe brings me back a bit to, again, my German roots and my German learning, because that goes very well in our German, or I mean, way back, definitely when I was trained in a company, we always had this mentoring. Call it coaching, but it was more mentoring, that this apprenticeship scheme. This is a very old, from the guilders in Germany, a very old value, that you have the master and you have the apprentice. And the master, by helping you to do the things, teaches you by doing. So, I mean, obviously like today apprenticeship, but we did it way back as well in Malta, for example. I had to think that we brought the first injection molding machine to Malta. I mean, injection molding was not known. And we as well did manufacture the mold. You know, the most important thing in injection molding is actually the mold. The mold is where the piece, plastic piece, is shaped in the machine. And mold making is a very, very high skill because it's fractions of millimeters, so very, very precise. It's, what shall I say, it's a 3D thinking you have to have. So you have to have very, very particular skills to go I mean, on a technical level, I would say it's one of the highest skills in mold making. And we wanted to do mold making in Molde, but obviously there was no knowledge whatsoever in Molde. And in Germany, you do that by apprenticeship schemes. So we got a mold maker, obviously a senior mold maker from Germany down to teach apprentices, youngsters, I mean, from trade schools at that time, because there wasn't the MCAS, so we had to go to the trade schools, which had a bit of a negative flair in Malta because they were seen as the schools were the non-achievers who didn't make it to university or to sixth forms were put aside. But it wasn't like that. These were the schools really for people who were more hands-on, more practical, wanted to do this type of jobs. And we got youngsters from there, 16-year-olds, and taught mold makers. And they learned over 3-4 years, because it's quite a process. And you have to assess as well, straight away, if the person has a bit of medical skills for this precision and for the 3D, but we taught a number of highly skilled mold makers. And it was a very funny incident. I remember it way back. It was then at the end of the 70s, more in the 80s, that mold making changed. Before it was very much handwork, you know, had to do filing and all that. But then it changed with technology suddenly, where all of a sudden machinery, milling machines and fully automatic took some of these jobs over. So we in Malta were still very much based at that time, middle of the 80s, on the handwork, because don't forget as well, labor costs in Malta were maybe 10-15% of the German cost, much, much cheaper, obviously. So we said, all right, we can employ people and train them, and it won't cost the company that much. But when all of a sudden this technology change came, we realized, and it was almost a bit late in the day, that we went the wrong way. Because Germany then had invested in this newest technology, which the machines much faster, much more accurate. And all of a sudden, even with our low labor costs, we became almost uncompetitive to this new technology because we worked with old fashioned machines. And we almost came to a point that we said, all right, mold making in Malta doesn't work, too expensive, even though with a low labor cost. And we won't anymore do any mold making in Malta. We had at the time maybe 20 employees, highly skilled employees. So we were almost on the point of running it down when I was contacted by another German company in Malta, good friend. And they said, listen, we heard that you are thinking of closing down or selling your mold making. We would be interested to buy it. And, you know, out of the blue, I said, all right. And then thinking this whole thing over, I said, why would they want to buy our mold making company? It's old machinery. It's nothing sort of, we are going to close it down. Why would they be interested? Until obviously it clicks and very, very, very suddenly, of course we have, 15, 18 highly, highly trained, good people. So what they wanted to buy was our people. And then I went straight away to Germany, whatever it came, you know, very, very sudden. I finally saw it. I said, listen to Germany. I said, wrong. We are totally wrong. Let's turn it around. Give us the best machines. Let's invest in the best machines. So our good people with the new technology can be far more competitive than Germany because their wages are still lower working these new machines. We did that. And I think today our mold making company is still in Malta. And the last I heard, we were something like 80 or 90 people. But it shows you as well how sometimes you can think wrong, you can get wrong, and then just one click. I mean, we would have done a very, very big mistake. So the value and the skills of people if need to be used together with the new technology in the right way. That's why I sometimes tell people as well when I talk, I said, don't be afraid from technology. Use technology where it can do what you do right now much better, and you do things which the machines can't do, where you are better than the machine. So you use a machine for, like we used to say as well, it's this computer and whatever, but it's not the computer. You control the computer. It's, you know, how to deal with technology as well, because people sometimes are very frightened and think, oh, new technology will take my jobs over. No, learn new skills. Let the machines do what you did now and learn new skills where you can again evolve, you can get better. So this is it's an ongoing process. And I think today with digitalization, it's one of them we have now. But what is important as well is, Joseph, that you need to foresee all that a bit. I mean, we know now where technology is going. It's going very, very fast. But I think even as a company, you need to already see the skill levels of your people, and will that be enough for the next 2 years, 3 years, or do you still have to already, or do you have to strain already for new skills? See again the strengths of these people, and where could you put their skills now if what they are doing right now could be taken over partial or all by a machine? So you need to constantly as well see to make the best use of the knowledge and the possibilities your people have to learn and improve, and then put technology in where it keeps you competitive as well to compete. I mean, it's a process which is, I think, exciting, very demanding, but it's something you need to do if you want to stay competitive and relevant.
That's interesting, because it's funny, because I just recently written an article, related to that particular point, where one, you need to do a job audit where you are auditing the job to understand what are the bare essentials that you need for that particular job. What skill sets do you need? And what additional skill sets are you going to need down the road as the role eventually expands? And then that leads from a job audit to a talent audit, where you are forecasting, as you pointed out, in 2 years' time, in 5 years' time, what's the direction the company is going to go in? What technology is going to come into place? What are the future competitors? And while you're looking at those different potential markets, you're identifying what skills are you going to need to prepare for when that time comes in 2 or 5 years' time. And it's important to do a job assessment or audits as well as a talent audit, because as you pointed out on quite a few points, is looking at the team that you have and identifying where they're strong and to be able to scale their strengths and to be able to support where they have challenges. And this is interesting because it kind of goes back to what we kind of covered earlier, but I think it's important to mention it again, or to at least go into more detail, because as part of the coaching process, as part of the mentoring process, you need to give them time to change, and you need to help them. You need to help promote this internal change. And this is where you create the, as you mentioned, the training center. So you may be repeating yourself a little bit, but can you go a little bit more in depth in regards to that training center?
All right. Let me look. What I think as well, and what we did, as I told you, I mean, we had employees who were with our company for a long time. But what was then good as well, that when people came towards the end of their career, that we use them more as mentors than actually than day-to-day running, because they knew the whole history of the company, they knew the values of the company, they were the company. So we use them as well very much to in-house training session on on our organization, on our values with our young people. So this mentoring or coaching, what to say as well, because was very much as well sometimes not the textbook, which you learn somewhere else, but it was much more the storytelling of our employees who have been with us and the whole journey. And there's nothing better than storytelling, let me tell you. And even young ones really like that. I mean, it's like when you have your grandchildren and they tell me, Nana, tell me, how was it when you were young? It is a human element that storytelling leaves much more impact sometimes than, sort of this episode, they remain with you. Like I'm telling you certain sort of highlights of my thing. So this, we used our employees who have been with us for a long time, which had been with our journey, very much in the mentoring capacity with our younger ones. But as I said, we were very much a company who as well always embraced the apprenticeship culture, which actually is that, the master with the learner. And I think you can do that in every aspect of your organization. I mean, like, for example, when you have a new employee, today they call it induction program, but you need somebody then to take on this new employee and mentor this new employee in, not just on the skill of the product, but also on the whole company philosophy, on the whole company environment, on the values. I mean, this is part of then belonging to this culture. And I think we used a lot our in-house people because they really knew it, they lived it. So we had enough employees to do that. But I always say as well to very small companies, in Malta, the backbone of our economy is actually this micro small companies with below 10 employees. You can do it much better in the small companies. Because that is where the apprenticeship scheme and comes from the German way of thinking, that you have the master with the apprentice. And in a small company, I always say as well, youngsters, sort of when they just come out of university or sixth form and they want to go into business, go in a smaller company, because in a smaller company, you are able to learn the whole spectrum of a business. If you go, I mean, this young one sometimes are dying to go to very big companies. But in a big company, you are in a unit. You are in purchasing, in operations, in sales, in marketing, in finance. If you go in a small company, you see the whole spectrum, what it all entails. I mean, owner of a company with six employees knows everything from the finance to the marketing to the sales. I mean, he's hands-on doing everything. So if he has a young one in the company, they will straight away through him, if he coaches them properly, learn the whole spectrum. And that is very, very useful later on. I mean, when I joined Playmobil way back in Germany, and I was just out of, I had done sixth form, I had done a traineeship, and I was for evening university for my BCom, and I was 20, 21, and the company in Germany had 100 employees. So I was with the owner, and he took me by the hand into the production, into the machines. Now, I had no technical expertise. I came much more from a finance administration background. But he explained to me, and when you are curious and want to learn, I asked all the right questions. So I ran a manufacturing plant at the end, not having a technical knowledge, but I understood the basic, and I was able to ask always the right questions and learn more. And where I needed more expertise, I got more expertise to help me. Because this is another thing, when you say about mentoring and coaching, Joseph, when you are, for example, like myself, the managing director or the CEO of a large company, you can't be an expert on everything. And I definitely wasn't. So I made sure that I had experts in all the field, be it from the financial to the marketing, but I was able to ask them the right questions, to bring over what we at the company had a vision, to bring their expertise together and coach them all to bring it holistically for the value of the company. But that is the leadership skills that you have right on top. You know, you can't be an expert. You are maybe a bit more inclined. I mean, I was always quite a good financial person and I had quite a good knowledge on sales, but on technically, I needed, obviously later on, at an engineers and technical people, but I understood the basic. I understood what questions to ask, what way to go. I asked them for expert input, but I could then bring it all together. So I think this coaching and mentoring has to be as well part of your DNA in a company. You know, I mean, don't just bring it in one time and then you think you have done it. It has to be as well consistent in your whole approach to the development of your people.
This brings us to an end of part one of my interview with Helga Alou. Find part two in 2 weeks' time as we talk business and continue our talk on how businesses can become more inclusive. As I take this podcast further, I am looking for ways I can engage with you to create more amazing content. It's because of this I've created a Patreon page where you can connect with me more directly with several options, including where you can watch full videos of past and current interviews. You can also find me on my social media, and I encourage you to join my groups in either LinkedIn or Facebook. I post the links in the show notes. Till next time, take a leap and transform.